Ben and Enosh, the daughters who had been sent to the distant boarding school of pleasing well-behaved girls, who drank tea and had breakfast with their family. Now here, in 1820, is a report of the life run on the Appalachian border that was admirable in every way. And evidence given according to high education status of life. Near the present city of Knoxville, Tennessee, the Hodgson spent a night with an old respectable farmer whom the children were sent to a boarding school about 8 miles away. Impressed with the manners of a daughter who served coffee, Hodgson offered the general observation that, quote, he would be surprised at the respectable manners and appearance of those he met with in this capacity, even in law cabins, close quotes. Traveling east of Knoxville, he passed children just let out of school who crossed him with a little while. Like young accident. And one of his hostesses who lived in the house with a neat white horse within 12 miles from the summit of the Allegheny Mountain, he declared he would appear highly respectable in any society, incredible as this may seem, of one living in the wild of America. Then in the 1830s, James Kirk Hawley, who wrote The Dutchman's Fireside, I believe, and who was a partner of Washington Irving in some of his publications, took a tour down through Appalachia, notably through what is now West Virginia. At that time, it was Virginia. And he stayed for a time at near White Sulphur Springs. And while there, he spent a night in the hole of a tanner. And if there is a typical mountain there, you see, here he is. A man living in a log cabin, a tanner, who is a hunter. He spent his whole spend night in that hole just to see what life was like there. And the cabin was presided over by an industrious fat wife and a mother of 10 tow-headed children, two of whom were of intermediate age and who were attending school not far away. When he first went in the hole, an older girl had shed herself to go and bring home two children younger than she. The school across the pathway across the field there. The important thing is, in spite of all he had to say about that tanner, who he said threatened to gouge him because he wanted to pay him 35 cents for more milk, like. In those days, we did gouge. I remember the last fight I ever had when I was a boy. It was a gouging fight. I tried to gouge my antagonist's eyes out with my thumb at him. That's been going on the border from the beginning. I don't know if it's a gouge anymore or not. Then another traveler through the mountains went through 1840. James Silk Buckingham was generally uncomplimentary by that time of mountain folk. But then about all he saw of them was what he could see from his carriage window. And we had a lot of that kind of report. And all those without exception was not very dependable. However, his reports, grudgingly, evidence here and there of an interest in the population and education. In the hostelry of a Mrs. Taylor, note that this is a good Welsh name, at Tallulah Falls in Georgia, he found a few books, All Tales, Romances, and the Commerce Order, that's a book, according to his judgment, and he concluded that at least some of the family could read a copybook belonging to the oldest son of the 13 children of the family, lay on a chair. And on the first page, written in the worst scrawl imaginable, he read, Wooden Taylor, his hand in hand, as good a stride as one in hand. I used to see that written in books myself. And Buckingham concluded from the entry that, quotes, the propensity for boasting is not confined to the seacoast in America, but has found its way into the interior also. By the end of the 1840s, though, travelers were emphasizing the ignorance and illiteracy that found among mountain people. Frederick Law Olmsted reported in 1854 that the number of mountain people who could be classed as moderately well educated in New England was extremely small, but he had found that the planter class, especially the women on plantations of Alabama and Mississippi, were even more illiterate than Appalachian people. Those who signed the Watauga petitions, perhaps all of the eligible, now that was 1772, perhaps all the eligible males and settlers signed it, only four had to make the marks. courthouses in the old counties of Appalachia have in them many documents, especially those that sent for daughters to Mary, written by first settlers. I spent the happy hours in the courthouse of Prestonsburg reading the consent notes that my ancestors, Lenning and Blaine, before Lawrence County it was founded, were sending to the clerk of them for their daughters to marry. Maybe many of you have had that experience, but imagine opening a note written by a great-great-great-great-grandfather and his signature there, his little heir of his very spent. It makes one feel that he belongs to a family to have that experience. Well, these documents themselves are remitted. The bold calligraphy and the formal rhetoric reflect a pride in an ability to write, and the curious spelling and the archaic grammar echo the Scotch-Irish heritage. You can still see on the old tombstones the Scotch-Irish spelling born, B-O-R-N-D. Many of these notes have that kind of spelling, and the spelling is not stabilized yet. Lyman Draper, who wrote a book about the heroes of King's Mountain, was pleasantly surprised at the high response in similar handwriting, and with the same kind of curious spelling and rattling rhetoric, to his invitation to veterans of the Battle of King's Mountain to write for him their recollections of that battle. There is growing evidence, as claimed by some investigators, that the Appalachian Mountaineers were more literate thanks to the presence among them of the Scotch-Irish from 1790 to 1830 than they have ever been since. And even today, when up to 25% of Appalachian people older than the age of 25 are functionally illiterate. Now, this must come as a shock to you, because I'm sure that you too have been brainwashed with enough to think that we had stinking, ignorant ancestors. And we did, most likely, but that was not an adequate description of them in 1790 or 1820. Or 1830. When Scotch-Irish pioneers reached Appalachia, they possessed not only a level of education higher than the average of other colonists they had met with when they arrived in America, but they had a broad Christian pluralism as well. They were Presbyterians in the case. Many carried with them into the wilderness copies of classics in Greek and Latin, which they could read, and cat-bound copies of the English poets. They named their children for characters in the Bible and in classical literature. A large family, most families were large, would have daughters bearing such names as Sarah, Rebecca, Naomi, Ruth, Mary, Martha, and Elizabeth, out of the Bible, and sons called Adam, Moses, Aaron, Abraham, Elijah, Elihu, Noah, Samuel, Solomon, David, and Jonathan. But among them also were Penelope and Phoebe, Cleopatra, Calpurnia, Cordelia, Matilda, Melinda, Helen. Helen, you know, was a Celtic woman, the daughter of the sun. And Homer, Terence, Leander, Plato, Ulysses, Virgil, Cicero, and the like. And these names tend to be handed down generation to generation. But they never named their boys Caesar. They somehow remembered that Caesar had butchered a million men. The love for learning and respect for learned people continued in Appalachia even during those poverty-ridden years following the Civil War, when hard-working farmers found themselves not scholarly enough to make out to read, but were eager to have their children go to school. Children of betrayal, hardship, struggle, the Scotch-Irish were well-suited for pioneering. They'd already been pioneers in Northern Ireland before they came here. Hardy, resourceful, innovative, and making use of what they had, daring, and sustained by Calvinistic doctrine, they were in effect a buffer against Indian attacks from older settlements in the eastern mountains in colonial times. But accepting individuals in terms of their own integrity and work of character, they were also friends of everybody who was individual. And that meant then that they would readily, though they were also radiant in violence. And one thing about Appalachian families of Indian descent that you might not find elsewhere is the high level of pride Appalachian families take in Indian ancestry, almost without exception. And well, I think it's true because that means that the Indians were either Shawnee or Cherokee, and those were splendid tribes of Indians. When they came into Appalachia, they had the confidence that they could wrest a living from the wilderness and did so. They were skilled in metals, or the Celts had learned from the black people on the Nile River how to smelt iron. They were the farmers of the Iron Age. Those carriages, the chariots that the Celtic women rode out to the Caesar's armies in, those marvelous chariots were masterpieces. Incidentally, the wind from wheel to wheel was exactly the same as the distance from the outside of a railroad, one rail to the other, is in contemporary times. They were skilled in metals, the oldest metal workers in the world. They were skilled in textiles and in leather. The leather work they did, some of it has been unearthed recently in London there. It's moats. Two, three hundred years old now. Moats. Yes. The books of 400 years. And it's still preserved and still has that marvelous tuning on it. And only these people knew how to do them. And they were skilled with woods. Had to be, because wood was very scarce in Northern Ireland, as well as in Scotland, when they came. They knew how to work it beautifully. And they were masterful in manufacturing the best cocktail whiskey in the world. And they carried that skill with them in Appalachia. And unfortunately, it's been perverted to be one of the social indictments against us. And we have the finest historical reasons for being skilled in the manufacture of spirits. It's our thing. And not only were they skilled on these things, but they were not prepared to survive as independent farmer hunters in isolated people, places, where they had been open country people for centuries. Thus, in Appalachia, they developed an open settlement pattern of living, maintaining distance from their neighbors and generally eschewing towns and cities. Until recent times, there were very few towns in all of Appalachia with populations of more than 2,000. Each family met as near as possible to those needs. Women processed materials from cloth and spun, wool, and sewed clothing for the family. Men tanned leather and made shoes, jackets, harnesses, and saddles. Whores reminded themselves of working with food and utensils. And from the Indians, they learned those native plants that could be used for food and medicinal purposes, and those free fruits that were edible. But they brought with them also a rich oil culture, in which we're becoming extremely interested in these things. Aphorisms, proverbs, songs, superstitions, rhymes, and ditties preserve for them the wisdom of their Celtic ancestors. The ballads and songs, the finest of tradition, related to stories of their ancestors. After the ballad revival, sparked by Professor Francis Child and Professor George Lyman Kittredge, collectors found more variants of the English and Scottish ballads surviving among the mountain people of western North Carolina alone that were at that time surviving in England, Scotland, and Ireland, all put together. Not only was the ballad tradition self-thriving in Appalachia, but the simple tunes to which the ballads were being sung were older and less contaminated by self-conscious efforts at artistic improvement than elsewhere. Another aside here. The ballad did fairly well in the Appalachian tradition until about 1950. When there was a revival of interest in ballad, this time by art singers. And they thought they could improve the Appalachian tradition by antiquing the tunes, that is, by making them Elizabethan. The tunes were already older than Elizabethan. They were simply spoiled. And so it is now very difficult to find a truly reliable Appalachian ballad singer. Their lyrical songs and their fiddle banjo tunes, adaptations of what their ancestors brought originally from the lowlands of Scotland, or learned from the Irish neighbors in Ulster, became in time the basic music of America itself and are the foundation of our country music. Their hymns echo the Gregorian chant. The preaching style of those old hardline Baptist ministers, for example, echo the ancient chants of their bardic forebears. They're still as pillars of faith, and their folk tales, still living on the tongues of many old timers, echo not only their Celtic origins and the familiarity of their ancestors with classical literature, but their struggle as pioneers in the Appalachian wilderness as well. We are probably, as a group, the best oral storytellers left in the world. That's been our tradition. We still swap lies, as we call these stories.